Morning, everyone. Thank you for joining me. Obviously, the call is to give you an update on our full year results just announced this morning for the year ended March 2022, and a bit on current trading as well. Just to give you the highlight, and by the way, sorry, I'm using the presentation that is on our IR website, the analyst presentation that was put on this morning. I'm on page four of that, just to give you the highlights. Revenue in the year was just over 1 billion sterling, which is a significant increase on the prior year, 54%. Obviously, there's a mixture of acquisitive growth in there, and organic. The organic component was about 20%, which was about half-half between volume and price. EBITDA, 163 million, which is a 28% year-on-year increase. I will come back to a margin analysis in a bit. Again, a record year in terms of EBITDA, of course, driven both by acquisitions and organic performance. EBIT followed at 108 million. We ended the year at about 2.7x net debt to EBITDA. That is net debt being not including. That's a pre-IFRS 16 measure, so not including operating leases effectively, which is how we measure it internally because it links to, for example, you know, our the way that it's drafted in our documentation, in our bank documentation. You know, that was 2.7x, down from 3.1x at the previous year-end. And that's, you know, we bought a lot of businesses in that time. We also did raise an additional 150 million of preferred equity with Koch in January this year, on improved terms. We reduced the preferred coupon by 100 basis points across both the new and the previous issuance. That also helped to bring down the leverage. As we've always said, we stick with our financial policy of targeting as we're going through growth phase, as we continue to invest in new acquisitions, targeting around 3x net debt to EBITDA. Obviously we raise finance through debt equity in accordance with that policy to target that sort of level, which is, as you can see, exactly what we have done. I'll come on to, I think that's good for the highlights. I think just to give some context, you know, the year, obviously our year-end is March, so we're talking about the year that started back in April 2021. Just to characterize it's, you know, hopefully COVID is not a thing that's gonna affect anyone anymore in a major way. It certainly was something that affected the business at the beginning of this financial year that we're reporting. It was around in terms of lockdowns in the U.K. and Europe right through to July last year, and then in Australia right through to October. It's still a year that was impacted by that in terms of lockdowns. That was one of the key backdrops of the year. The other thing, of course, is inflation. Of course, everyone now is focused on more recently energy price inflation, whether that's gas or electricity. For us, we saw inflation through the year. In fact, in some of our key raw materials, we saw inflation, significant inflation starting the year prior. It's been a year definitely of dealing with inflation, if cost inflation. I'll come back to that again in terms of when I'm giving you the margin analysis. It's something that we have always been good at dealing with. We have scale, we have a fragmented customer base, we have flexible operations. We have mitigated that inflation where we can through operational means and otherwise through price increases. We've done that very successfully, and I will come back to that when I look at the margins. In that context of those two things, I think, you know, a very successful year again. Certainly the management team are very pleased with it. We have gone through a number of additional integration and synergy projects as we've clearly bought a number of businesses. You know, overall, we're very pleased with the result. Just to quickly talk through those acquisitions. We bought five businesses in the year, one in the U.K. and Europe soft flooring division, which as everyone knows, is primarily carpets and underlay sold in the U.K. and artificial grass made in the Netherlands and sold around Europe. The business that we bought was an artificial grass business in the Netherlands to consolidate with the previous two businesses that we already had in the Netherlands in artificial grass. We bought two ceramic tile businesses in Italy. And we bought one ceramic tile business in Turkey, which was more recent. In February, we completed that deal this year, which provide us, and all of those are low-cost businesses, and provide us with a good low-cost manufacturing base. The Turkish business, by the way, sells predominantly exports in hard currency in euros into Europe. But the manufacturing is based in Turkey. And then finally, we bought a business in the US, which is our first. I mean, we previously exported into the US, but we have now our first actual operations in the US, a business in California, in San Diego, called Cali, which distributes hard flooring, mainly vinyl products and wood, vinyl planks, LVT, LVP as they call it in the US, and wood planks through the US. It doesn't manufacture. We don't have a manufacturing base in the US, but certainly it's a very strong brand in the US and a very strong distribution capability through omnichannel, both to consumer and to business through retailers of, you know, the likes of Lowe's and Home Depot down to regional players. And also tradesmen. So it's a full omnichannel business model in that US business. And that's obviously new for us and forms a new division, a fourth division in North America. So if I go over to sort of slide 7, I mean, there's not much to say there. That just shows you that historical track record over the last 6 years. Again, a mixture of acquisition-led and organic growth through that period. If you go over to slide 8, and this is one where I do want to talk for a bit, to talk about the margin. There's been two big effects on the margin this year. This chart shows a bridge of EBITDA margin from last year to the prior year, FY21, to the year just ended March 22. And one of them is an effect we have every year, which is, every year when we make acquisitions, which of course we have made every year in the last few years, which is that we generally buy businesses that have lower margins than our incumbent group. And that is not necessarily by design, and it's not necessarily a bad thing because we pay multiples of profit and of cash flow, of course, rather than of revenue. So we're still paying perfectly good prices for what we're buying. But, you know, we like to think that we have done a great job with maximizing the efficiency of our operations. And so generally speaking, we are buying businesses with slightly lower margins, also because of scale. And then, of course, we integrate them and try to deliver some synergies and improve those margins. But certainly in the first year, at least, you know, they tend to be margin dilutive just mathematically as they are consolidated into the group results. And that's exactly what's happened this year. And of course, we've made 5 acquisitions this year, which is a lot. So that has had quite a material effect of around 2 percentage points negative, purely mathematically consolidating those acquisitions in with their margins at the starting point, if you like. The second one is something that is distinct to this year. Of course, everyone's aware of significant inflation. As I mentioned earlier, that has been a feature for us, absolutely, but, you know, a feature for us for some time. I mean, for example, in carpets, synthetic yarn is the biggest component of raw material in terms of cost, and you know, that had significant inflation going back to the late part of FY20, and so we've been dealing with a much higher price of that through the year. As I mentioned, we deal with that through operational means where we can, or supply chain competitive means, and then, of course, through also ultimately through passing on to our customers. But the key thing is, because it's been so significant, what we haven't done is we haven't tried to add a markup to when we passed it through. So we're absolutely passing through, and FYI, our revenue in terms of the effect of price increases has gone up by more than our cost base has gone up through inflation. So we have absolutely, in absolute total terms, passed on the bits that we couldn't mitigate it by other means, but we have not added a margin on top. So of course, just mathematically, you protect your absolute bottom line, but because your revenue is growing through those price increases, your percentage margin goes down. And we just didn't think that would be the right thing to do, either for us competitively or for our customers, frankly. So and in some cases, we actually have, for example, surcharges where, you know, a bit like sort of fuel surcharges that airlines charge, we have in some areas energy-related surcharges that fluctuate with the energy price, and that we've introduced this year because it's a good way for us of dealing with that with our customers. So that has had, again, a mathematical impact on our margin, even though we have successfully protected the bottom line in absolute terms. And that was, as you can see on here, 180 basis points. Once you account for those two factors, then actually I mean, it was a bit flat, but actually there was a 50 basis point uplift in margin other than those two things, which came down to you know, some of the ongoing synergy projects, and I'll touch on those again in a minute, to what they were. So yeah, overall, I think that's important, because clearly if you look at the face of it, you say, well, your margin's gone from, you know, 19 to 16, but you know, there's very good reason for that, and as I said, it really is the mathematical impact of those two factors. Page 9 just goes through some of the divisional performance. We had a very, very strong year in the UK and Europe soft flooring. As you can see, the like-for-like growth there of 30%. Like-for-like growth, by the way, is pure organic, strips out acquisitions, the impact of acquisitions, strips out currency differences, constant currency, strips out the extra week that we had in the prior year reporting period as well, because it was a 53-week period in the previous year. So it's true like-for-like. Organic performance on revenue. It was very, very strong there. Still double digit, which is, I mean, as everyone knows, we're in a mature industry that is generally pretty stable and doesn't really grow or shrink for that matter, you know, through the cycle, generally more than sort of low single digits. So to grow at those sort of percentages is a fantastic result. And I've talked about the margin, so I don't plan on dwelling on this. Everyone can sort of read the numbers. The next three pages, so 10, 11, and 12, show exactly the same margin bridge, but for each of the first three divisions. It doesn't include North America, so obviously that's brand new, so it's not so relevant. But you can see there, for example, on 10, that in the UK and Europe soft flooring, the acquisition effect, that was the grass business, actually it was very good margin business, so it didn't really have a big effect in terms of acquisition mix, but we did pass on a lot of inflation without markup that did have quite a material effect on our percentage margin. But otherwise, we then improved the margin through some synergies, which I will discuss. Over the page on 11, ceramic tiles had both, because the Italian ceramic tile business that we bought in particular were very low margin businesses when we bought them. There was a lot of operational strategic reasons for making those acquisitions. They're quite small ones, but we've been able to integrate and deliver a lot of synergies through the integration of those operations and the couple of factories that we acquired. And again, inflation was absolutely a feature in terms of passing through that cost inflation. And then in Australia on 12, we didn't buy anything in the year, but so no acquisition mix effects, but again, there was an inflationary effect. And the Australian margin, other than that, did go down slightly by 70 basis points, as you see there on the right on page 12. Again, just to reiterate, Australia was more impacted by COVID in the year because its lockdowns lasted a lot longer. So over the page on... So that sort of really, I think, covers the underlying performance of the group and what we've done high level in terms of acquisitions. Just to touch maybe before I get into non-underlying items and cash flow, just to touch on the synergy projects, and there's a section in the presentation which I won't go through on every slide, but I'm talking about slides 18, 19, 20, 21 here, which go through more of this kind of commercial and operational initiatives in each division. But just to touch on that briefly, we in the UK, there was one small, which started, you'll see it in our previous annual report, we had a final a project to consolidate manufacturing. We had two factories in Yorkshire, which have been doing natural fibre products, so wool products, which we consolidated into one factory. So there was a bit of final work on that. And then ultimately we sold the site that we vacated. And we invested heavily, by the way, in the new site, in the other site, so that has increased capacity. But it's much more efficient now, and we sold the site and made a gain on that. Of course, that gain we've taken as a non-underlying, as exceptional, effectively. But anyway, that was the project there. On the logistics side, we are still investing. We've got a brand new DC, Midlands-based DC, that is currently under construction. But that will help us to continue to deliver the service proposition. And just to remind everyone, on the carpet side in particular, service proposition is key. Yes, products are important, you know, in terms of design, innovation, quality, but also we service, as everyone knows, the mid to high end price point. We don't do stuff at the cheap end of the market. And at the mid to high end, cut length business, i.e. where we hold the stock on behalf of our customers who are the retailers, and they get an order and we back to back that order with finding that piece of carpet in the distribution center, cutting it to size for their consumer order and sending it back to the retailer. That service is fundamental. We do it very well, as you can see in here. We are second to none in the industry. We have a 95% on-time delivery record. We have a very, very high percent next-day delivery record. That is absolutely invaluable. Competitors are literally lining up to ask us to do it for them. That is key. And we're still investing in that area for that very obvious reason. In terms of ceramic tiles, mainly it was investment and integration in Italy. We bought these new couple of businesses, one of which was Santa Maria, which came with a new factory. We did a lot of investment into that factory to make some improvements in terms of margin, also to increase atomization capacity, which we then atomized the clay for the other plants in Italy as well. And we put in a new line at Serra, which is our original factory that we bought back in 2017. And we also put a new line in Dom, which is a factory bought back in 2020. So a lot of investment in Italy. That business has an absolutely full order book. If people remember, it focuses mainly on the DIY retail channel, which is still very buoyant, and the order books are absolutely full. Spain is more mid to high end, more specialist brands through independent retail. It has absolutely remained solid through the Q1 so far. We're not being complacent. We know that consumer headwinds potentially are coming, but it's a solid business at the upper end of price points. And then Turkey, which is new for us, is again a cheaper, as I mentioned, a cheaper manufacturing base to complement our overall manufacturing base, and is mainly exporting into Europe, but its cost base is very much in Turkey. And then Australia, basically we didn't buy anything in Australia, so Australia was very much just an organic story. And that business, and if you might remember from the prior year, we saw significant top line and margin growth in Australia in the prior year. There was a 590 basis point increase in the margin. So again, the margin did suffer a bit this year because of, again, that passing through the inflation without a markup, but off the back of a 590 basis point increase in the prior year as well. I think Australia's had a fantastic year with 11.4% like-for-like revenue growth, which is different to the 10% there, by the way, because that's just reported and the 11.4 is currency adjusted. And then North America just finished. It's a new division, but that business is growing extremely well. It grew at 17.6% CAGR from 16 to 20. And then since then, i.e. since we bought it, this is comparing to a time prior to having bought it, but it has continued to grow. It's grown at 22% in effectively our first year of ownership. So fantastic growth, lower margin because it's a distribution business only. We are looking to uplift that margin. We are looking to sell some additional products that we make in Europe through that network. It's a very exciting business for us. So that was sort of the commercial highlights, if you like. If I flip back to slide 13, just to talk through exceptional items and look clearly very important. This slide, I produce the same slide every year for several years. It summarizes all of the exceptional non-underlying items. The distinction being exceptionals are one-offs, whereas a non-underlying are not necessarily one-off, but they are considered to be not representative of the underlying business and certainly not cash. And I'll come back to that. And then I'll talk about the non-underlying finance costs as well. So on the exceptional items, you can see this is where the things highlighted in blue are the cash items. So you can see this is where most of the cash exceptional items reside. But these are things like exceptional costs related to M&A, due diligence, legal costs, and so on. Clearly, it was higher this year than it was in the previous year because we made a lot of acquisitions. So 10.7 million on advisory fees. And just to be absolutely clear, we do not exceptionalize any internal ongoing cost. If I spend my time working on an M&A project, my time is still very much underlying because I'm the CFO and I will still be here next year and so on. These costs are third-party professional fees in relation to things like acquisitions, DD, legal, or in terms of reorg as well. The only exception in reorg, of course, is that includes severance, redundancy costs where applicable. So, and the real costs here, again, that relates to the synergy projects I was talking about. So we're talking about Italy there and a little bit in the UK. There was negative goodwill, which is that next one. That's actually an income. That basically means that under IFRS, the purchase price that we paid for a couple of our acquisitions, which were one of the Italian ones and the Turkish one, was actually lower than the fair value assessed for the balance sheet on opening. That goes straight to income, but of course it's not. We treat that as exceptional income. It's not real income representative of the business. And then you can see below that there's a 2.9 million income as well on the right-hand column. And that was the gain on sale of the property that I mentioned earlier, where we've closed that factory in Yorkshire and sold the property and made a gain. Again, treat that as exceptional, of course. The non-underlying items, the main one and the biggest one, as it is every year by far, is the amortization of acquired intangibles. This is, again, under IFRS, we fair value the balance sheet. We have to identify any intangible assets when we buy a business and put them on the balance sheet, effectively, instead of just putting it all the difference to goodwill. And these are, for us, brand names and customer relationships, and we have to recognize them and then amortize them over a period of time, which is sort of 10 to 20 years typically, depending on the situation, depending on the particular acquisition. Clearly, that is not cash because we paid for that through the purchase price, and clearly, once that's fully amortized, we don't have to pay any cash to reinvest in that asset. So we don't treat that as an underlying cost. The other big ones in there are acquisition-related performance plans. That's effectively deferred consideration on acquisitions. The reason it's called acquisition-related performance plans is because under IFRS, if it has any link to employment, and what we do with our earnouts is we say to the guy who we've bought the business from, or people we bought the business from, you need to stay and run it to deliver your earnout. And by the way, if you leave, then you lose your earnout in that period. And because it has that link to them staying, it has to be treated effectively as a non-underlying employment-related cost under IFRS rather than technically an earnout. But effectively, it is an earnout. It's certainly drafted as an earnout in the SPA contract. And then the 5.3 million unwind fair value uplift to acquisition opening inventory, that's a mouthful. That is, again, you fair value the inventory on opening balance sheet. So literally, that means rather than it being at the normal, which is the lower of cost or net realizable value, you now value it at effectively what you're going to sell it for, less your selling costs. And so what that means is all that inventory that on the opening balance sheet of the business you bought, you're not going to make any profit on it until you've cleared it and replaced it with new inventory. Now, of course, that doesn't reflect what the business is actually doing. It doesn't reflect the cost that target business has paid for that inventory and the profit that on its own it has actually made. So we take that uplift that sits effectively as an increase in cost of sales in the income statement, and we treat that as exceptional so that the underlying profit reflects effectively the contribution from that underlying target business before that fair value adjustment was made, that fair value accounting adjustment was made. In terms of finance costs, the main thing here is costs relating to the pref. We have the host instrument itself. We had to separately identify from that any embedded derivatives, the key one being a redemption option, a bit like we have with the bonds, clearly, which is also separately identified on the balance sheet, FYI, the redemption option. We have to fair value that redemption option. We have to. There are some warrants, equity warrants, ordinary equity warrants, from the initial issuance, not from the new issuance. We have to separately value all of these things, and so effectively the host instrument is held at amortized cost and the other things are fair valued on the balance sheet. We treat the P&L movements in that as non-underlying because a lot of that is movements up or down in fair value. And at the end of the day, as everyone knows, this preferred equity is equity. We don't have to serve it ever in cash. There's no default, there's no acceleration, it's subordinated, at the end of the day, if we don't do anything with it, it will ultimately convert into ordinary equity. So we treat those costs as non-underlying, because those are not cash costs, as you can see. The only cash cost element of that was we paid it. We used to have, before we did the recent issue, we had a commitment from CED to give us another 100 million on the same terms as the original terms, and there was a cost associated with that. That's now gone away because we did the deal back in January this year, but that cost that was associated with that commitment, which is that 6 million, was effectively netted off in the proceeds we took in January. So that's gone now. That's it. Really, those are all the sort of material items. There's some translational differences in there and a fair value adjustment to the redemption option on the bonds, which you can see in there as well, which we have to value. So moving on to cash flow on slide 14. The cash generation was slightly lower this year for two reasons. One, we invested significantly in inventory and raw materials. Clearly, people have concerns about, in general, I don't mean us particularly, have concerns about supply chain through the year because of COVID initially, and then other factors more recently. We see that easing now, but certainly through the period we decided to increase raw materials as a buffer to that. And that movement in working capital that you can see on the far right-hand side, that 26.3 million, if you look in the actual the main cash system, you'll see that's all driven by inventory. Now, we don't think that's a normal level. You can see we had a similar uplift last year than previous year because of COVID as well. And we are overstocked. We fully expect that to decline. We hold that in raw materials so we can convert it into different products. And we'll manage that back down over time. So that will reverse. The other reason is if you look down in about halfway down, just below halfway down in replacement CapEx, there's a number there of 40.9 million. You can see that compares to 20.9 million in the previous year. And effectively, the previous year we underspent because of COVID lockdowns and just COVID general caution. And then we did a bit of a catch up this year. So we spent more. And of course, the CapEx is going up as the business grows, but that's definitely more than we would have otherwise spent because of the catch up. So for those two reasons, the free cash flow generation was, and the cash for debt service was slightly lower than normal, but completely in line because it was all down to those two factors. It's not a complicated business at the end of the day. We make a sale, we send the product, we invoice, we receive the cash. And so in the end, of course, as with all manufacturing business, it is down to how you manage the inventory. That is the key thing. And we do a very good job of that. Just flipping over then to 15, this is the bridging that cash flow into the net debt. So and this net debt, just to be clear, is effectively, because it's pre-IFRS 16 net debt. So it is not including leases. That's because we look at it that way. It's defined that way in some of our lending documents and so on. So we look at it internally. So this is traditional net debt, if you like. 3.46 million at the beginning of the year. We generated that free cash flow there, which is after everything, after interest and so on, and tax. We then also raised some money, which is the press, which is that 1.42 million. And then what did we invest that in? We did some expansionary CapEx and some of those exceptional items that I mentioned that were part of either, in investment in real cost, the synergy projects. So we did some organic investment, if you like, in growth projects or synergy projects, 15 million. And then, of course, you can see the biggest bar there is we invested in those five acquisitions and associated costs. And then there's some translational differences to bring us to 406 at the year end. And our leverage was lower. So, and of course, that's helped by the pref equity issuance. But again, just to make the point that I made at the beginning of this call, which is our leverage is 2.7 at the year end. It was 3.1 at the beginning of the year. As we've always said, we have our firm financial policy of targeting around 3 as we continue to make investments. Obviously, if we went into more steady state and made less investments, less M&A, we would lower that down to around 2. But 3 for investments is where we're absolutely comfortable. And as you can see, we finance ourselves appropriately to maintain that policy, which we will absolutely continue to do. That is, I think, it. Just to give you a little bit on sort of current trading and outlook, there was a short statement in the announcement this morning. The Q1, which is obviously for us April through June, was overall in line with our original budget expectations, which was set much earlier this year, at the beginning of the calendar year. So, that's very positive. There are some positives and minuses within that. I would say where we've seen a bit more pressure is on UK soft flooring on the more volume side, on the cheaper end. I say we don't do cheap, but we do mid to upper end. Definitely on the highest price stuff generally is more resilient. We've seen that in the past as well. Where people with high disposable income are sort of less affected and the people buying the more expensive products. At the medium end, we have to move around our price points and do a bit of product reengineering and make sure we're hitting the sweet spot for consumers. But certainly that's where there's a bit more pressure. But then to be fair, as you just saw in the numbers, we saw, 30% like-for-like organic growth in that division in the previous year. So, it's probably no surprise it was coming off such a strong comparator. So that's where we see a bit of pressure. The other area that we see a bit of pressure is in the US. Obviously, we have we have our new business in the US. Actually, it's doing a very good job of managing that and mitigating that. But certainly in terms of our outlook on on what is happening currently in the U.S. market. Consumer demand levels in the U.S. are more subdued and have been during that period, that Q1 period. But we're confident in our ability to manage that. That has been offset by very solid performance in ceramics, helped by those synergy projects that I mentioned through that period, and a very solid performance in Australia, and a very solid performance in artificial grass. Overall, a good quarter. Of course, we look forward. We're not complacent. We know that there are headwinds. I think we're confident in terms of inflation and our ability to continue, clearly, because it's been very significant already, to manage that. Consumer demand is what it is. I think everyone knows that our business, we don't sell, apart from very limited cases like in the U.S. with that Cali business, we don't sell to consumers, we sell to retailers. But our sales are very much real-time to consumer sale. We generally do back-to-back sales. We like that because it means there's no destocking risk with our customers. We get very real-time data of what's selling, what's not selling, what's going on in the market. So, as I said earlier, our Italian order books are full. We see strong demand still in a number of areas, but we don't want to be complacent. And all I can say is, look, I think we are very well in terms of demand, right? And so I think we are very well positioned in the industry in terms of our scale, in terms of the flexibility of our operations. We have very low operation leverage, as people remember from the initial very extreme COVID lockdowns. We managed that very effectively in terms of cash and in terms of, well, at that point, it was all about cash. We didn't care so much about profit. It was more about cash. But in terms of cash and profits, we managed that carefully. We have the ability to flex our operations significantly. And if necessary, we will flex our operations. But so I think competitively, we're in a great place. And of course, in a large fragmented industry, that's what you want because you effectively, in the end, want to do better than your competitors. So I'm not going to crystal ball gaze, but I can certainly say that I think we are very well positioned as a business to deal with any challenges ahead. I think that's probably where I will stop and move to Q&A. Thanks very much.
Thank you. So if you would like to ask a question, please press star followed by one on your telephone keypad now. If you'd like to remove your question, please press star followed by two. And for those who have joined online, please press the flag icon. Additionally, when preparing to ask your question, please ensure your phone is unmuted locally. So we take our first question from Elena Van Hagen from APG Asset Management. Please go ahead.
Yes. Hi. Good afternoon. Can you hear me well?
Yes, I can hear you. Yeah.
Perfect. Yeah. I had a couple of questions. The first one is in terms of inflation and your margins. In the press release, you mentioned that in fiscal year 2022, there were four price increases in order to catch up with inflation. So my first question would be, since April, you have implemented or announced new price increases. And the second one is, I understand there's a big inflation factor, but I also understand, as of today, inflation is not going away. So what can we see as a sustainable margin? Is it more in the 70%, or is 16% a margin that we should be working in our models going forward? That would be my first question.
Sure. Thanks, Elena. So I think in terms of price increases, we operate in an industry that doesn't work with, as I said, it's a lot of back-to-back to consumer demand. So there aren't fixed volumes. There aren't LTAs. And so in terms of pricing, it does literally come down to what is the commercial dynamic between you and your customers. And so there is no fixed formula. We obviously want to be respectful to our customers and work with them. But as you can see, and as you mentioned, the sort of four, I mean, it clearly varies, by the way, between different product areas, different brands, and so on. But absolutely, we put multiple price increases through in a year, anywhere between three and five, I think, across all of those different products and brands. And whereas in a typical year, it would be one. So we can absolutely do it. And to add to that, I think I mentioned, but I might be misremembering, in some areas, for example, we've added just a surcharge where we literally have a formulaic surcharge that this is now really ceramic tiles that links to literally the price per megawatt hour of the gas. So it's literally a daily, weekly fluctuation. And yes, it'll go down as well as up. And that, again, we made that decision because we think that's the right thing for us, but also for our customers. So, you know, our ability to put, so we have put through price, moved prices since the year end, absolutely. And I have absolute confidence that we can continue to do that. In terms of the second part of your question, I mean, look, no one was expecting, you know, double-digit inflation. And so, yes, that has absolutely affected our margins. I hope my explanation was clear as to what was going on there. We haven't suffered that in that year. There was no suffering in terms of our absolute profits. Yeah, we, you know, if you're making 20 of profit on 100 of revenue, then we're now making 20 of profit on 120 of revenue. Yeah, because the costs have gone up, but our revenue has also gone up to match. It's just that your percentage margin has gone down. Now, look, so the answer to your question, it really does depend on what happens with inflation. At some point, it will go down, of course. And I'm not saying that this year or next year, but and then we'll start to come into a more normal scenario where, you know, additional margins come back into play. On a percentage basis, we start to recover that margin. And absolutely, and historically, we've always said, look, you know, we're targeting around about 20%. And look, by the way, that does depend because there's very, you know, soft flooring is generally sort of, if you're doing really well, like 15-16%, and ceramic tiles, you can achieve higher margins. So that is still an average. But yeah, as a group, I don't see a change in the medium to long-term position being 20%. But in the short term, as long as significant inflation arises, we'll protect our absolute bottom line. But that, yeah, that may mean that on a percentage basis, it stays more around this kind of mid-teens level. It really depends on what happens with inflation.
Sure. And you gave a couple of comments in terms of that the first quarter is looking okay. So just to give us an idea, since the beginning of April, are your like-for-like sales still increasing at double digit, or have you seen some softness in demand? And I think that's the main focus on all these industries is of course, prices have grown significantly, but what's happening with volumes? And especially the Ukrainian war. So are like-for-like sales still as strong as double-digit growth in each of your categories? You mentioned some softness in the U.S., but any comments on that would be highly appreciated. Thank you.
Sure. I mean, I have to, you know, I have to follow what we said in the public announcement, but it's in terms of disclosure, but it's. I think I added some flavor there. The US is softer. The UK but US is new for us, right? And we see a lot of opportunity there, so we have no worries there. The UK is softer, but coming off an extremely strong comparator. To give you another sort of indication, we are trading at above pre-COVID levels. Yeah, if you kind of cut out the last 2 years. We are growing over, you know, we've grown organically over the period before that. I think it depends. It's going to vary by, you know, I think it's difficult for the UK to beat such a strong comparator, but it's absolutely for the Q1 we've been in line. So a bit softer in those areas, stronger in other areas. Yeah, stronger in Australia, stronger in grass. Ceramic tiles have been probably somewhere in between and absolutely robust, but all very much in line with the original expectations. Just to touch on, just because you raised it, in terms of the situation in the Ukraine and Russia, I just wanted to make clear we didn't have any material direct impact from that. So we don't have a sourcing issue. We didn't have significant sales into those regions prior anyway. So really. For us, it is just it's about the knock-on effect or whatever. Anyway, the general global situation in terms of inflation and demand. But the Q1 was absolutely solid. But I don't want to sound complacent because we fully understand, and we are taking many, many actions already now to prepare ourselves if we do need to flex the operating base and so on. We're constantly taking operational actions.
Yeah, and then one last question. Thank you very much, and I move back on the queue. In the press release or in the presentation, you also mentioned that leverage adjusted for Balta is at 3.3 times, because I understand Balta closed up fiscal year. What is the EBITDA contribution of Balta that you're considering pro forma? If you could help me with that, please.
So I think it's around about in sterling terms about 30. That's post IFRS 16. It's only about 2 million on the IFRS 16 adjustment. So we're talking about 28. Look, Balta for us, and I just want to be clear, and hopefully we made this clear in the announcement, we bought effectively what we believe to be a fantastic rugs business. We believe there's a very, very strong future for rugs continuously as hard flooring is the largest flooring category. Yes, soft flooring is very strong and continues to be in the UK and in Australia, but hard flooring is very strong elsewhere. And so we think that the rugs business, and they've done a great job in building that rugs business. 50% of what they sell is exporting to the US, which is significant growth. It used to be far, far less than that. So I think the point I'm trying to make is, we also bought the Broadlink business, and there is significant integration, and I think we made it clear in the announcement, we're looking, unlike other projects where we integrate stuff in a few months, maybe a year, this is a two-year project. So we are looking to make some significant improvements, but it will take time, and people need to bear with us on that. But yeah, to answer very simply your question, it was about 28 million.
And that doesn't include any synergies, right?
That doesn't include synergies.
Okay.
Yeah,
thank you very much. Congratulations.
Anyway, just explained the delivery. Oh, thank you. Thank you very much, Elena. That's very kind.
Thank you. Congratulations on a good fiscal year. Excellent fiscal year, actually.
Thank you.
The next question comes from Harry Simonali from Morgan Stanley Investment Management. Please go ahead, Harry.
Thanks for taking my questions. Congrats on a great set of numbers for last year in what clearly were challenging circumstances. Just thinking about the year ahead, in the Outlook report, you mentioned on several occasions that you benefit from low operating leverage. So just in that context, could you just talk about what are the fixed costs that you have or you will have, given that you need to have the ceramic plants running at certain minimum capacity utilizations? Could you just talk about that? And could you also talk about what plans or contingency plans you have in case of energy rationing? Is there any particular region where you are a little more vulnerable, and is it possible to shut down, for example, say, kilns in Italy and just run them off Spain and Turkey and transport it to those markets? Is that something that works? So that's my second question. Third question is in terms of energy hedges. I believe some of the hedges will come off this summer. So could you just talk about how you're hedged going forward? And finally, could you talk about any exceptional integration costs this year, given that you had 5 acquisitions last year? Thank you.
Okay. Sorry, Harry, could you just repeat the very first question that you asked?
Just in terms of, you mentioned in the Outlook, in the very detailed report, that you benefit from low operating leverage. So could you just quantify the fixed costs in your cost base right now in the context of, the fact that you have 20-odd kilns, ceramic kilns that need to be run at a certain minimum utilization level and so on. So could you just talk us through that? Thank you.
Absolutely, I will do. Sorry, thank you. So yeah, operating leverage. Clearly we have different parts of the group, but actually it's not a dissimilar picture across the board. So we've done some analysis previously, and you'll have seen in the original bond issue documentation, and also I don't think it's in this presentation that you've got in front of you now, but certainly did it, for example, last year's presentation. We had an analysis on, and apologies that we didn't repeat it, on operating leverage. Of course, there are, there are things that are clearly fixed, and then there are things that are more subjective as to being sort of semi-variable. So, but to give you an idea, overall, broadly speaking, the absolute fixed part of the cost base that you cannot turn off no matter what, is about 10% of revenue. On top of that, everything else is technically variable. Some of it is directly, and a big chunk, I'm talking 55 to 60%, is directly variable, i.e. we're talking raw material costs and completely flexible labor or energy costs, for example, that literally just directly relate to your level of production. And then there are things that are semi-variable. You'll have sales teams or product development or so on, things that you don't really want to shut down in the short term, but you absolutely can do that if you need to, you know, if you see a significant decline in volume. So that's the sort of overall picture. In what we do, of course, there's a lot of subtlety to this. So, you know, if you look at a ceramic tile factory, you have a kiln. What you want to do, because the kiln is the thing that's using at the biggest cost, because that's where the gas goes, clearly, you want to maximize the efficiency of your kiln. You want to make sure that when you're running a kiln, it's running at 100, you know, 24/7, there's product going through that, maximum efficiency. And that's absolutely what we do. So if you're not needed, you don't need a kiln, you shut it down. Now, that's easier said than done sometimes, because you need to take about a week to shut down a kiln because you're dropping the temperature from 2,000 degrees down to effectively room temperature, whatever. But you know, you can halve it. You can quickly bring it down to about half temperature, or you can just shut it down. So we absolutely do that. Yeah, and so there are, you know, as I said, within a week or a few days, there are some timing differences, but we flex our operations to meet our stocking requirements and our demand. Labor, of course, you would say is fixed, but there are a lot of, it depends on the country, clearly. In some countries you operate in, there are significant, not even part of COVID, just ongoing initiatives around ability to temporary furlough people. We deliberately use a proportion of agency staff and deliberately use a proportion of overtime shift work in our operational labor force, because those things can be flexed. So you pay a bit more for those things. You pay more for overtime than otherwise. You pay more for agency staff, but you can flex it very quickly. And we deliberately find that balance to allow us to flex quickly. And if you remember, when COVID occurred, we, at the very beginning, just as an example, I know this is a long time ago now and it's a different situation, but just like everyone else in the world, we pretty much shut down everything for 2 to 3 months. And in that time, we didn't lose any money, because we were able to shut down very, very quickly and very, very significantly all of our operations. So I'm not going to sit here and tell you that, you know, we can manage it if demand went to zero. Clearly, that's not the case. But I think, compared to what most people would perceive for a manufacturing business, it is very flexible. And that's partly down to the way that we run it. Soft flooring is even more flexible. A big part of soft flooring is the tufting process, which is highly modular. You have, you know, a bank of 20 tufting machines in a factory, and you can use or not use those as you wish. That is easy. And the biggest cost by far is the yarn. So it is very flexible, and we do have a lot of capacity to move things around. And then linking to your second question about gas shutdown, clearly, the highest risk for us, everyone will be aware, is Italy more than Spain, because of where they source their gas from. We stay very close to this as far as we can do in the industry, very clearly. The whole industry does, as you can imagine. We are lucky in the sense that we, I think, have very flexible operations. We do stock, of course, so we can, you know, that gives us some months of leeway. To your point about could you move between countries, like, it is absolutely possible. You can produce ultimately the tiles on different lines in different countries, but of course it's not ideal. You'd rather, for efficiency purposes in a steady state, be producing the same stuff on the same line continuously, because that's how we set ourselves up, because it gives you the best margin. So anything's possible, but you'd always have to make a judgment call at any given point in time. How long is this going to last? Can I handle it through stuff I've already got in stock, and basically what is my strategy here? So those are the calls that you have to make, and of course those are things I think we will do perfectly well if it ever comes to that, by the way. There's no such risk, I think, in Spain or for us in Turkey. In terms of hedging, we do have hedging in place. It varies by country. You can generally hedge gas. Oh, we hedge other raw materials as well, by the way, in where we think necessary, and we do a mixture. Sometimes hedge some spots, some hedge. And gas, in particular, for, and again, this is purely ceramic tile conversation, okay? Because we do use a bit of gas in carpets, but it's a tiny proportion. This is really a ceramic tile cost, and it's a cost for the whole industry, by the way. Everyone uses gas, and you'll see in our ESG report that comes out with the annual report in a couple of weeks that we're investing in a new factory that uses a new type of technology to reduce the gas consumption significantly, and hopefully one day remove it altogether. But anyway, that's for the future. So in terms of gas, this is what everyone uses. That is, no one has a way of making a tile without gas. We do hedge. You can hedge a lot more in Italy, as it happens, than you can in Spain because of local reasons with the gas companies. We have probably, I think, the most hedging, or certainly a very high proportion. I think we're at the top of the industry. That benefits us, but it benefits our customers as well. So, for example, we have more hedging available in Italy. We're able to do more with the pricing than we can in Spain, where we are hedged, by the way, and quite significantly, but you just can't do it as much in Spain, both in terms of quantum and in terms of outlook, in terms of number of years. So, you know, we're absolutely, you know, effective use of any hedges that we can. And that was an ongoing thing before this crisis, right? So we, you know, those aren't things that we put in place all of a sudden recently. We've had hedging arrangements in place for quite some time. And then in terms of exceptional costs, your final question, I mean, look, they will arise. So in terms of projects, the biggest is going to be, and look, we haven't announced or decided, frankly, specifically, but as I mentioned earlier, Balta is going to be a two-year project, and clearly that will come with some exceptional costs because there'll be some operational stuff that happens there to deliver synergies. But, you know, apart from that, we're done pretty much in the UK, apart from this DC that we're building in the Midlands that I mentioned. And in ceramics, unless we buy anything new, there's a little bit more in Italy, but effectively, you know, there's not a lot more. So I think real cost is going to be heavily focused towards Balta as we optimize the production from the factories that they have versus our other factories in the UK and in Turkey, because we also have Balta has soft flooring manufacturing in Turkey as well in the rug side, and then look, M&A is just dependent on the M&A, so could be zero, could be a number, we'll see. So hopefully that answers your question.
Very, very helpful. But could you just quantify, are you fully hedged out or partially hedged out for the current, for the financial year ending 23? Normally, I think 60 or 70%. Is that proportion still being maintained?
We're very well
hedged. And could you just quantify to the extent possible the cost in 23, please?
I can't tell you the details of the hedges because it's all confidential and commercially sensitive, so I can't possibly do that. But we are very well covered for this current financial year that we're in to March next year, and in some areas beyond.
Brilliant. And cash cost for 23, can you quantify that, please?
Say that again? Cash?
The cash cost in relation to integration. You did mention the qualitative aspects as to which country, Balta, and so on, but could you just provide some numbers to that, please?
We have not decided, and look, I can't say because we have not formally decided what restructuring we're doing, and we haven't announced anything, and so therefore I can't possibly comment.
Okay, understood. Thank you very much, and all the best for your next endeavor.
Thank you very much. Thanks, Aaron.
Okay, the next question comes from Tadas Malanuskas from Triton Partners. Please go ahead.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear. There's a little bit
off
your line, but yeah,
no,
I can hear.
Yeah, quick question. The first one on the hedges. Do you have to put them on the balance sheet, or how does it work? Because I was trying to just find some info on the annual report and couldn't find anything.
So the hedges are they on the balance sheet? Yeah, they are effectively on the balance sheet, but. They're just mixed in with other working capital, effectively. We don't do anything. Don't try and do anything funny with the hedging, frankly. It just is what it is, and it flows through to benefit the profits as the prices, the gas prices move around, and as we benefit from them for our operations.
And is the hedging with your suppliers, or is it in the paper markets? Can you just give me a sense of what form of hedging this is? Then?
Sure. Your line has improved a lot all of a sudden. So it's all. I've got to be careful, okay, commercially sensitive, but it is largely with suppliers, because it's actually very hard for corporates in general, I'm not talking in our industry or anyone, corporates in general, to get commodity hedging from banks. You can do it, and actually we do have some to top up, but it's much easier to hedge directly with suppliers, and so that's what we do. We fix prices with suppliers. We don't, by the way, that doesn't mean fixing volumes. It just means fixing prices for the volume that we use. So it's a good situation to be in. And I just want to reiterate that, you know, our that then feeds through to our selling prices as well. We modify our selling prices to the benefit of us. So the hedging benefits us, but it also benefits our customers.
Yep. And then one more question on the, I think in the presentation, there is a statement around that you have commercially sensitive plans to ensure gas supply continuity. I don't want to. You know, obviously you can't share too much about it. But I guess just in terms of the confidence that you have in terms of maintaining supply if there is rationing, where would you rate that? You know, on a scale of, I don't know, 0 to 100. I guess what does that statement really mean? You know, practically for your ability to continue business if there's rationing.
I think if there is rationing, then there will be serious shortage of supply in the industry in general, for wherever that rationing is occurring. So let's pick Italy, we may as well, as the obvious example. I think the Italian industry, yeah, and that will create a supply issue, which will benefit anyone who's still supplying, whether that is from Spain or Turkey or elsewhere. I think, it just depends on the circumstances. If there is talk of, you know, supply stopping or being rationed, and I think maybe rationing is more likely than absolute stopping for a few weeks. But if there was rationing, I think we can manage that, because we can basically run lines at different times, and we have done that in the past, by the way, for this reason and for other reasons. So. Would we have to, obviously we wouldn't be able to be at absolute full capacity, but in Italy if that happened, but I don't think it would have a massive effect. And certainly if there was, you know, if you said, well, what's it going to be the effect of your business of stopping gas supply entirely for a few weeks or even a couple of months in Italy, I'd say, we'll manage that, that'll be fine. If you said it's going to stop for a year, I think that's pretty extreme, clearly, for the entire country, but then that would be a different scenario.
Get it.
And that's the sort of scenario where we would be, even though it's not the optimal thing to do, that's the sort of scenario where we would be clearly looking at manufacturing products that we make in Italy elsewhere. Yeah?
Yeah.
But, you know.
That makes sense. One other question is on volumes. If you split them up in the last fiscal year by some sort of period, maybe half year to half year, I guess within the 20% organic growth you mentioned, half is volume, half is price. How does the 10% volume increase? How does that look if you just look at H1 and H2 year on year?
It's definitely stronger in H1. Yeah. But it was still positive across the board and healthily positive. I'm not saying positive and it was like 0.1. Was still healthily positive across the board in H2. And that's partly... I mean, I don't know if that's because of early impacts on demand of inflation, but also it's definitely an effect of H2 was coming off a stronger comparator. So, Matt, in terms of the numbers, in terms of comparing year on year in the half one period to half one period and half two period to half two period, half one was stronger, but it was all positive and nicely positive.
Get it. And very last question, hopefully a quick one. Do you have any factoring of balance sheets or on balance sheet for that matter that I wasn't able to find when reading the report?
Before we bought Balta, we had none, effectively. We have some factoring facilities because they're very common ways of having effective and very cheap working capital management facilities in different countries. But to the extent they're used, it's literally for that purpose, like ad hoc for a bit of working capital funding because it's cheap. We didn't have a permanent piece of funding in the group that was factoring. So there's plenty of times where we don't have any factoring drawn at all, but we like to have the facilities because it's just a common type of facility to have in depending on the country. But we're talking small, right? These are small local facilities, you know, business by business. Balta, the business that we bought, did have some factoring. It was about 30 million euros. We disclosed that in the announcement when we bought it, yeah? And look, technically under IFRS, because it's non-recourse, it's off balance sheet, but we are very open about it, right? Like, we bought that business with factoring. And does that factoring still exist today? It's a little bit less, but yes, it does. Because, again, it's a good facility and it's cheap. But that's the only factoring. Yeah, we've inherited that. And when we talk about the purchase price announcement, that's built in. We're not trying to hide that from anyone.
Makes sense. Thank you so much.
It's a bit under 30 million euros, basically. That's euros, by the way. No problem. Thanks for that.
The next question is from Tapio Dakasari from Axia Asset Management. Please go ahead.
Yes, thank you. I would like to ask about the page 30 on your presentation and your ESG commitment. So are you planning or considering setting specific targets for how much to reduce your carbon footprint in the future?
The short answer to that, Tavi, is yes. Look, we're on a journey with that. I don't want to – whatever I say, you might think, well, it's a headline or whatever. We are trying very hard. By the way, we take it very seriously. All of the businesses that we've bought individually take it very seriously. We're trying to create a cohesive framework across the group. And, of course, as you buy businesses, you know, you have to evolve that. We've put a lot of effort into that in the last 12 months. And we'll continue to do so. We've hired a couple of different consultants to help us do that as well and to build that framework and to know where we should be focusing our efforts. And a lot of data gathering has happened and a lot of like high-level view of the different initiatives where and the areas that we want to focus has happened. And things are coming out of that. Have we got to the point where we are identifying the relevant KPIs that we want to track and set targets? No, to be very open with you. And that will be probably in the following ESG report. You will see an ESG report. I can't even remember how long it is, but 8-10 pages long of the ESG report in our annual report this year. When that comes out, that'll come out, by the way, and just it always follows the prelims probably in the next week or so. Look, absolutely. We just don't want to be I don't want to use the word term greenwashing, whatever. We just don't want to be just doing something to tick the box. We're doing this properly. Just give you some high level, like when it comes to the environmental part, which is obviously, you know, a very big part of it for a manufacturing business, you know, when it comes to energy and carbon, that's clearly an issue that we focus on in ceramics. It's not really an issue in the energy consumption, and especially it's just a lot less in soft flooring than it is in ceramics, vastly less. And in ceramic tiles, as I said, we are looking at a new factory that we're developing that uses a different technology to replace the gas. This is something completely new and would be new to the industry. That's for the future. That's the issue that we're looking at there in terms of carbon emissions and in terms of energy consumption. Not an issue on electricity, by the way. We generate our own electricity from the heat that we produce from the gas. So we actually sell energy back to the grid. In terms of waste management and product life cycle, it's the flip. So that is not an issue in ceramic tiles. Ceramic tiles are natural products inherently and do not create a landfill issue or anything like that. And we do have means of recycling things back into our products as well. It's more of a focus on in carpets. And as much as we produce plenty of natural fiber products, the whole world in terms of consumer base has moved to more to liking because of their properties, synthetic products. That's where the demand is for consumers. We can produce either, right? And on the same machines, and we'll follow that. And we're also looking at a few different things. We've got a few projects that I obviously don't want to talk about in terms of recyclability. And then on the underlay side, underlay is naturally a recycled product. We use virgin waste from other industries and also consumer waste in elements to recycle into our products in underlay. So we're looking at all of these things. There seemed to be a bit of a focus in the past from, I don't know which notes, on chemicals management. We don't use that many chemicals or hazardous chemicals. Where it does exist is more in soft flooring than in hard flooring. And we've looked into it very carefully, and we have all the necessary controls in place, and it's continuously risk assessed across the board where we use them, and we've never had any issues, and we are always looking at ways of reducing that. So there's no real issues there. But yeah, look, a serious focus, yes, and it will evolve more and more.
Okay, yeah, thanks. Good to hear that there's a process ongoing. So that's all from me. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
The final question comes from Konstantin Wolf from Western Asset. Please go ahead.
Yeah, hi. My questions have actually been answered already. Thank you very much for all the remarks and presentation.
Pleasure. Thank you, Konstantin.
We have no more further questions, so Michael, I'll hand it back to you.
Well, thanks very much, everyone. It's been a pleasure, and obviously, as a group, we look forward to continuing to deliver. And thanks again for your support. Thanks very much. Cheers.